Okay, so it's my pleasure to introduce to you Richard Beck. He studied Christian ministry at Abilene Christian University, which is actually where he teaches now, before going on and getting a master's in clinical psychology and then his PhD in experimental psychology. He's the chair and is a professor of psychology, but he's focused his research into this intersection between psychology and theology. And so he's made use of the environment in which he's in to study things like depression, homesickness, and first-year students, retention of college students based on their worldview and how much time they spend on Facebook. and he also looks at how, attachment theory informs our relationship with God, which also fits well with some other programming that SAS has sponsored in the past. So I stumbled upon Richard's blog, Experimental Theology, about a year ago. And I was attracted to his very approachable style of talking about psychology and theology, as well as incorporating a lot of fun things from contemporary movies and books, right? And so it was a really, I was instantly attracted to his writing. I was excited that he was willing to come all the way from Texas to a slightly colder environment for November. He's going to talk to us today about hospitality, and in particular looking at discuss psychology and the way in which that influences hospitality in the church. He's also written a book called The Authenticity of Faith, and I think you have another one coming out on the slavery of that. And so something interesting about Richard personally. He apparently is a very awesome uncle, who is known as the vampire hunter and the hunter of
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation. It's good to be here with you all. I was in chapel this morning, and that was a great time. And I spent some time. I don't know, is Christian back with us? They're in his classes, and so looking forward to visiting with all of you. I think I go about an hour, and then at the top of the hour, stopping and have some questions. I think you'll have many. The main material I want to go through is from this book behind you. Those are not my feet. Just everybody asks. A book titled Unclean. Meditations on Purity, what is my title of my book? Purity, Hospitality, Immortality. I don't know, has anybody read the book out of curiosity? A few of you have? Well, great. I'm glad nobody has, because that means everything will be new and interesting for all of you. Those of you who have, there will be some new stuff at the very end. And so I always like to know that, because it won't just be a complete rehash of the book or whatever. Let me tell you kind of about the story about where the book came from. I remember I was in church, my friend Mark Love, who's a biblical studies professor at our church, was talking about this whole idea of Christian hospitality. And he was talking about the Eucharist, the Lord's table, and he made a statement that was very distinctive, stuck in my head. And he said, you know, it's noteworthy that in the Christian faith, the central symbol of our worship is a table, the central symbol of Christian gathering and community, and our ritual is this family table. And he talked about this kind of how the Eucharist kind of enacts Jesus's ministry of eating with tax collectors and sinners, and how we are welcome to the table and welcome other people into the fellowship of Christ. And I remember that being a real, it's probably one of those, if you're a person like me, one of those moments where you kind of see what the kingdom of God, what the church could be, and you're like, yes, I see that. But then, as I began pondering that, obviously, and I'm sure you have noticed too, that the church often doesn't live into that vision of kind of radical hospitality or welcome. And so I began pondering, from my discipline of psychology, why is that? What makes it difficult for us to be people of welcome and people of hospitality? And my thoughts were drawn to a story in Matthew 9, the calling of St. Matthew. This is Caravaggio's picture of the calling of St. Matthew. I need to point that out because apparently this is not how people in the first century Palestine dressed. It needs to be interpreted for a bit there. But Jesus is the one there at the right pointing to St. Matthew, who's pointing at himself as he's called out of the crowd, like, really? A tax collector like me? My attention was drawn to this story because when the Pharisees are looking at Jesus eating with tax collectors and sinners as he goes and accepts the hospitality of Matthew after he calls him, the Pharisees call Jesus' disciples aside and say, hey, your teacher's eating with tax collectors and sinners. And Jesus responds by quoting the prophet Hosea and saying, you need to go and learn what this means, that I desire mercy and not sacrifice. And that tension between mercy and sacrifice, and why that tension even exists, is kind of what this presentation's all about, what the book's all about. Why is there a tension between mercy and sacrifice? Because Jesus attributes the failure of welcome, failure of hospitality, to this thing called sacrifice and the way it is trumping the call to mercy. What's going on in that tension? Walter Brueggemann, some of you might know, Old Testament scholar, in this book, The Theology of the Old Testament, his argument is that one of the things that was going on in that discussion was that in the life of Israel, that there was a kind of a live debate about a tension that existed at the heart of Israel about how to define uprightness before God. What does righteousness before God mean? One answer came from the Levitical purity code tradition. So that's kind of, you see up there, the scapegoating ritual on the Day of Atonement, where the scapegoat is expelled from the community with the sins of the people laid upon it. So there's this Levitical impulse to uprightness before God is defined as cultic kind of purity before God. But over against that, in kind of a dialectic, that you often see the prophets in the Old Testament critiquing the pursuit of Levitical purity. Many of you are probably familiar with Isaiah's famous indictment of kind of what true fasting is supposed to be, and how he puts issues of justice and mercy at the forefront of the life of Israel. This is what uprightness before God is. Not this cultic purity kind of thing, not the sacrificial impulse, but this justice at the gates. And so what we see in Matthew is these two tensions kind of collide in this incident, where the Pharisees are kind of regulated by this idea of purity, and they're withdrawing from the tax collectors and sinners. Jesus is crossing this boundary to embrace tax collectors and sinners, and Jesus defends his move by citing the prophets, apparently siding with the prophets over against the Levitical purity codes. The reason why that's interesting to a psychologist is because the psychology of purity is very fascinating, and you're going to learn a lot about it here in the next couple minutes. It's regulated by a whole suite of appraisals and emotions, largely governed by the emotion of disgust, and that's the disgusting part of the presentation today, but also the appraisals that drive disgust, appraisals of contagion and contamination. And so what I want to do is kind of talk about that psychology, because in many ways, the argument I'm going to make is one of the reasons why we have failures of hospitality is that when we regulate our experiences through the idiom of purity, we're importing and activating a suite of psychological mechanisms that when they activate, undermine welcome and hospitality, as you see in the life or the response of the Pharisees in Matthew chapter 9. Now, to get to that argument, we're going to have to learn a little bit about disgust psychology and its relation to intimacy and love and welcome. So let's begin with a famous example. A lot of this research is research done by a gentleman named Paul Rosen from the University of Pennsylvania. And Rosen has a very famous demo that kind of gets right at, I think I'd start my book off with this demonstration. And what he asked people to do is to gather some spittle in their mouth and then just swallow it. Just swallow the spittle currently in your mouth. And we can all break into groups and do this, but that might be awkward. So most of us can do that with no problem. But then he'll give people a Dixie cup, and he'll ask them to spit into the Dixie cup and then to re-drink it. How many of you would find the prospect of that a little bit disgusting? Probably? Okay, that's good. You're well-adjusted people here, I guess, you know. The question is, what's the difference? Right? What is the difference between those two acts? Swallowing the spit in your mouth and quickly expelling it and then re-drinking it. There seems to be little physical difference between the two, but psychologically, one is not disgusting and one is. That illustrates the first aspect of disgust psychology, that it's a boundary monitoring psychology. It monitors the boundary between the inside and the outside. What is inside is okay to be ingested, but what is exterior, even if it's just exterior for a moment, is still exterior, and therefore we're hesitant to reincorporate it. Now, what happens is, obviously, because we're symbolic creatures, this boundary of selfhood gets extended. Obviously, disgust regulates the boundaries of the body, but it gets extended to personal spaces, to churches, to homes, to political realms. Those spaces become regulated by the idiom of purity, and it becomes a boundary monitoring psychology. Obviously, that's problematic when you're speaking about issues of welcome and hospitality, where somebody marked with disgust psychology would therefore be marked as exterior, alien, or foreign. The other thing about disgust psychology, obviously, is that if you did happen to drink something or saw somebody drink something that was disgusting, what would be your kind of initial reaction? What does the feeling of disgust make you want to do? Throw up, right? It's an expulsive psychology as well. So it's not just marking outside and inside. It has a very clear recommendation about what you must do, which is expel from the interior to the exterior the contaminating agent. Makes you feel nauseous, makes you want to vomit. Well, going back to the scapegoating ritual, it makes sense if you're trying to achieve purity, therefore, to expel the scapegoat into the wilderness. I mean, there's lots of different things you could do to purify. You can maybe light the scapegoat on fire, or throw it in a well, or I don't know what you could do to the scapegoat, but there's many things that could have recommended themselves to dealing with sin. The most intuitive thing, though, because of the logic of purity, is to do what? Expel it outside the camp, outside the gate. And that would make sense because the contaminant would be expelled from the community and out into the wilderness. Let me give you a heads up here. One of the interesting things about the Gospels is how, particularly in the Gospel of Hebrews, it says, what does Jesus do? Jesus is found where in relation to the gates of the city? He's found outside the gates of the city. The location of purity, the cross, is found outside the gates, and the call is to go what? Outside the gates. And that's very counterintuitive. That doesn't make a lot of sense given the logic, the natural grooves of disgust psychology. All right, so those are kind of two things I want you to hold in your mind about disgust is boundary monitoring psychology, expulsive in mechanism. Now I want to talk a little bit about contamination. My apologies for the large bug. Let's talk about contamination. How does contamination work? It's not, disgust literally means in the Latin something that tastes bad. But not everything that tastes bad is considered disgusting. Your first taste of coffee might find it bitter, but it's not disgusting. So when is something appraised as disgusting? And it's usually when it's appraised that way when it becomes in contact with a contaminant. So let's talk a little bit about the logic of contamination. It's governed by a variety of rules that psychologists have called kind of forms of magical thinking. For example, Paul Rosen's research would take a cockroach, put it in lemonade, and then take the cockroach out, and it would ask people if they would mind drinking it. And again, they would usually decline, okay? But then this is where it gets interesting. That's not science yet. He'll then filter it right in front of the person. He'll filter it and filter it again and then ask people if they would drink it. And they still won't. Even though they know that once filtered, it's been rendered pure. And it illustrates one of the properties called permanence. Typically, when something is rendered contaminated, you're unable to rehabilitate it. Once you see the hair in your pasta this evening and you take it out, you're not, you know, although some of you have very low disgust sensitivity and you're like, whatever, it's a hair, right? Right? Well, you know, that's disgusting. You shouldn't do that. No, we do vary in disgust sensitivity. My point is most of us, but if you do, if you happen to render something contaminated, very little can be done to rehabilitate. It's a very catastrophic appraisal in that sense. Let me pause here and say something real quick about that too. Because one of the interesting things about this kind of idea of permanence and non-rehabilitation is that we don't use the metaphor of purity evenly across sin domains. Okay, we don't, for example, typically think about materialism as a purity violation, right? Most sin categories tend to be regulated by a metaphor, like an ambulatory metaphor, a walking metaphor. And so when we sin, we stumble and fall. And so that metaphor has a very clear rehabilitation. If you fall, you what? You get back up and go on. Performance error metaphors are fairly straightforward to fix. You make a mistake, you do better. But a purity metaphor with its non-rehabilitative frame are much more difficult to fix. And so we often don't think about like honesty as a purity violation or materialism as a purity violation, but we do have a certain set of sin classes that are relatively uniquely governed by purity metaphors. And those are what? What sin categories are those? We will talk about sexual purity, and I would argue for you today that it is no mistake that those are the hardest sins to rehabilitate. And I would argue that some of that has due to the way we've metaphorically framed that sin category, because the attribution of permanence is in play. And once rendered impure, there's no way to, quote, get that back ever again. And we don't think about other sins that way either. Again, that's just kind of a one-off example of how psychological framing affects moral reflection or even theological reflection. Let me give you some more disgusting examples here of contamination thinking. The next one is similarity. Similarity is Paul Rosen's people will bake things like brownies in the shape of like feces. I know. This is what passes for peer-reviewed publications in my discipline. He will also put lemonade in a clean bedpan. I use this one a great deal. I don't do the baking, but I will put lemonade in a clean bedpan. And he'll ask people to eat the brownie or drink the lemonade out of the clean bedpan. And again, most reasonable people would decline to eat or drink any of that, even though they know. Right, they know that that's a brownie, and they know that's just lemonade in a bedpan. It just looks like a contaminating substance. And so again, what we see here is that this response here is governed by an appraisal that's not necessarily logical. In fact, we know it kind of is irrational. But it looks like a contaminant, and that's enough to emotionally draw the feeling of disgust out of us. How does that import into spiritual realms? Well, what's one of the problems with Jesus in his ministry? When he shows radical hospitality, what's kind of one of the big knocks against Jesus? He kind of is similar to a sinner. He looks an awful lot like him, right? The Son of Man comes eating and drinking, hanging out with tax collectors and sinners. He looks like a contaminating agent. He's not distinct enough, and so he gets judged as being a sinner, even though he is not. Now, I would say that lots of church people struggle the same thing. You start spending too much time with those people or too much time in those kinds of situations, you look like one of them and therefore are judged as impure or unclean. The last one I want to talk about here is negativity dominance. This is really disgusting. If I took, and I've done this with students, I tell them it's dog feces, but it's really a Tootsie Roll, because I'm not that crazy. I'm not as unstable as that bison out there. Because it says it's an unstable bison, which as a psychologist is riveting to me. An unstable bison. If you take dog feces and like an apple, and you touch them together, and then you offer people the apple, would you eat this? They would say no, right? That makes sense. It's come into contact with the contaminant, and that contact renders it impure. By the way, that's another attribution here. Contact is one of the ways it's transmitted. So the problem with Jesus is his contact with tax collectors and sinners, his proximity to them. But the main thing I want to illustrate here is that although the feces renders the apple inedible, it does not go the other way. At least not for me. The apple does not render the contaminant edible or delicious. It's not a reciprocal relationship. And this is called by Paul Rosen negativity dominance. The negative dominates over the positive. Contagion runs that way. The powerful thing sits with the negative. That's interesting for a couple reasons. Mainly it has to do with this issue of hospitality, right? Because it suggests in the moment of contact, if the idiom of purity is regulating the way we think, in the moment of contact between the pure and the impure, between, let's say, the church and the world, or the saint or the sinner, or Jesus and the tax collector, if you are using purity as your psychology, how does contamination flow? The power resides with the sin in the sinner, and Jesus, in the judgment of the Pharisees, is rendered impure because of negativity dominance. That is the intuitive rationale that is governing the way they think. But one of the things you'll notice about the Gospels is time after time, Jesus inverts the vector of contagion. When contact with Jesus when the woman with the blood disease touches him, Jesus is not rendered ritually impure. When Jesus sees the leper who's unclean, and he calls out, Jesus, Son of David, would you make me clean? And Jesus touches him. Jesus isn't rendered unclean, but the woman with the blood disease and the leper are rendered pure. Jesus is, in a sense, positively dominant. And that is unintuitive. That is against the way it typically works, and therefore, I would argue, takes a great deal of learning and rehabilitation in our thinking, because that logic is just not the way we reason about purity and pollution. And I think it undermines the missionality and hospitality of the church because we think negativity dominance is the way it goes. You know, the power resides out there in the world, not in the purity of the church. By the way, I would also argue that story of the leper is like my favorite story in all the Gospels because it's vision of hospitality. You guys know in the Levitical code, the lepers would have to wear bells and have to scream out unclean, unclean, and people would scatter away from them. And so when that leper comes to Jesus and calls out from a distance and he says, Son of God, would you make me clean? Jesus does not say, be clean, and then embrace him. That's a different story. The story is, he says, I will, and it says he touches him. And I would say that touch is in many ways the essence of hospitality. The standing with him in his uncleanness. And at that moment, once that is secured, then the word comes, be clean. I'll come back to that toward the end of the presentation. Okay, the point here is, you can see how if we start thinking through the way we deal with others, and if we're using the metaphor of purity, then we're importing into that moment all of this psychology that undermines our ability to embrace. We become worried about boundaries. We start being, our natural impulse is to expel or to stand back like the Pharisees. We think, we worry about contact or looking too much like those people. We worry about negativity dominance. And ultimately, I think all of those things undermine what Miroslav Volf calls the will to embrace. One other aspect of disgust that we're going to walk through. Disgust, obviously, is a psychology that is focused on what, food, oral incorporation of food. But we also see disgust is a very promiscuous emotion where it gets applied to a lot of other things. I'm going to walk through these here shortly. But it's obviously, like we've been talking about, it's applied to moral infractions. Sins or moral failures are considered to be pollutants, things that contaminate us. Obviously, social groups, social stigmas or disgust properties are often imported into certain classes of individuals. And they are, these people become vectors of social contamination. And lastly, most interestingly, disgust gets associated with the body. There are existential aspects of disgust where the body and its vulnerabilities to disability and decay become vectors of disgust as well. In each of these cases, I'm going to talk about how disgust, when it shows up, impurity shows up, how hospitality is undermined. Let's talk a little bit about morality. I've already told you about how the idiom of purity comes to regulate moral failures. But this actually goes really deep. And many psychologists argue that this connection between morality and cleanliness is actually perhaps innate. In an interesting bit of research on what's called the Macbeth effect, a psychologist, you guys know Lady Macbeth, right? Lady Macbeth has a sin, and you know she's complicit in a murder, and so she's trying to wash her hands. She walks the night washing her hands, what's the famous line? Out damn spot, she's trying to rub that sin away. And you might think that's just a form of magical thinking, but this affects all of us. Everybody is susceptible to the Macbeth effect. Because the connection between purity and morality and disgust and virtue issues is just a natural, innate way we think about it. This is what these researchers do. They'll have a control group, and then they'll have the experimental group. And the experimental group is asked to contemplate their worst sin. What's the worst thing you've ever done? The most shameful thing morally you've done? We are going to do a group project on this, so we're going to get together and you're just going to share that with a neighbor or whatever. Right, so they have people kind of think about that, and obviously that brings up a lot of shameful, icky feelings. Creates feelings of guilt and kind of a moral contamination. And here's the interesting part. As the subjects leave, the control group leaves, and those who have contemplated their sins leave, they would give them a little thank you for coming gift. And some are given like a little sanitary wipe, and others are offered a pencil. You can take one of these. You can have a pencil or a sanitary wipe. And psychologists have shown this, that those who contemplate their sins are more likely to reach for the sanitary wipe on exit. What's even stranger and perhaps more sinister is in addition, on post-test examinations, it also, if they use the sanitary wipe, their feelings of guilt attenuate, go down. So literally it makes you want to wash your hands. Washing your hands actually attenuates your feelings of guilt. And worse, in another follow-up to this study, the experimenters had a graduate student show up asking them to help out with another study. And a little act of altruism, a little volunteerism. And they found that when people washed their hands or chose a sanitary wipe, they were much less helpful, much less likely to be altruistic. It seemed like once they kind of had washed their hands and attained a state of moral purity, they become less interested in being helpful to other people. That's interesting to me because it suggests that kind of ritual acts of purification can kind of actually make you unhelpful. You stand in your ritual purity and become unempathic towards other people. It makes me wonder about going to church on Sunday. And, you know, I feel clean and good, and maybe I'm not as helpful on Monday because of church on Sunday and my ritual state of purity that I've achieved. I wonder about that. My point here is simply that this shaking off this psychology is not easy. It's not a simple matter of decision. Some deep psychological biases are in play, and it's going to take time and effort on the church's part to kind of eradicate these things from her life. Obviously, the most pernicious aspects of this psychology are when disgust properties attributed to kind of other other human beings. Now, I'm sure we can fill up a large conversation with examples of where classes of people have been considered locations of contamination. You can think of Nazi Germany and the way the Jews were considered to be, you know, the purity metaphor in Nazi Germany was pretty intense. You can see it in American society during the Jim Crow South, where the African American population were considered to be, has anybody seen The Help, the movie The Help? You know, I mean, sharing a bathroom with the African American population, sharing a water fountain with that, I mean, that was one of the main places dining with. So you notice locations of separation, you know, separate water fountains, separate bathrooms, separate dining locations. And so that's all obvious, right? I mean, when you start looking and attributing disgust properties to another group of people, dehumanizing them, that's a bad thing. And we can feel pretty superior to that, but I want to share some research with you to suggest, again, that this tendency affects all of us. This is research on what is called infrahumanization. In psychology, infrahumanization is the process where some class of people are considered to be less than or subhuman. Okay? Obviously, with the Jews and the African American population, we saw how that works. But we are all prone to this kind of psychology. Okay? Now, the research, to explain the research to you, I need to explain a little bit about emotions. Basically, at root, infrahumanization is denying or hesitating slightly to attribute fully human status to an out-group member. Now, most of us are aware that this goes on, because think about the people who voted differently than you did this last election. There's something clearly wrong with those people, okay? Now, I know you are also Mennonites, and so many of you didn't vote. So there's clearly something wrong with those people who voted for anybody, okay? Right? Think about the Mac and PC users, right? There's something wrong with somebody who uses a PC, you know? There's something kind of somewhat snobbish about the Mac user, right? There's something, think about the way we think about out-group members. We tend to insult their intelligence in some way. Because think about it, if people were as fully smart as you and I, they would do as we do, right? Their difference can only be attributed to a lack of IQ or a lack of morality. I call it the three D's to my students. I said, out-group members are one of the three D's. They're either dumb, they're dishonest, or they're demonic. One of those three, right? They're just not as smart as I am, or they're just lying to themselves, or there's something malevolent going on underneath it. So we all know what this is like. In this research, the research they were looking at had to do with what's called primary and secondary emotions. Primary emotions in psychology are emotions that are shared across mammals. Basic kind of, like emotions you would share with your dog. Okay? Like, does your dog feel fear? Yes. Could you surprise or startle your dog? You know? Can your dog feel kind of happy? Yeah, right? Those are basic primary emotions. Secondary emotions are considered to be kind of quintessentially human, reserved for the human species, and these are kind of higher emotions like nostalgia and pride and those kinds of emotions. So if you think about slavery in America, the slave owners were not dying emotions to slaves. They believed they had primary emotions the way any animal would have emotions. What they denied to them was secondary emotions, right? If a woman on the slave block was separated from her child on the slave block and they went to two different masters, there's no doubt that she might feel sad about that. But she would not feel the sadness and the loss as acutely as a white woman would, because her suite of emotions were limited because of the infrahumanization. You with me on this? Okay. In this research, psychologists, using a variety of reaction time tests, were assessing the speed at which people would attribute secondary and primary emotions to out-group members. And across a wide variety of situations, applying these emotions to people who speak a different language, across racial groups, across sexual orientation groups, and even across institutions, the way y'all feel about universities across town, even across institutions, there is a hesitation to attribute secondary emotions to the out-group member. This is called in psychology the mere assignment effect. This effect has been shown when people come into a laboratory, two people, we flip a coin, and because it's heads, you go this way and it's tails this way. And when people get on this team, even though they know that our group has been decided by something solely a flip of the coin, that's what binds us together, the human mind will begin to rally around this group based on nothing and will begin to show favoritism to their group and begin to punish out-group members sheerly because of that. It's just the way the mind works once we get a group together. And that becomes the process of infrahumanization. What I'm saying to you is that we all experience this. There are slight hesitations in every human heart about every out-group member. And for the most part, they don't manifest themselves. But during times of stress and strain, during recessions or other times of conflict, those gaps that are sit latent in our hearts begin to widen. And then we see at the end of that game is genocide and the worst. But we often don't see ourselves as vulnerable to that kind of out-group stigmatization because we don't think we're vulnerable. But we all are. It's just the way our group psychology tends to work. And we often don't experience it as disgust. We often experience it more as superiority or contempt. Charles Darwin was one of the first to notice that the wrinkling of the nose in disgust is the same wrinkle of the nose with aristocratic disdain, looking down your nose at another person. Contempt and psychology are very, contempt and disgust are very closely linked. The only difference is contempt is hierarchical. It's a peering down. And this is interesting for the issue of hospitality. Remember I talked about disgust being a boundary monitoring psychology? That which is inside the boundary is me, and that which is outside the boundary is exterior alien. In research with marriages, John Gottman's research on marriages, he will get married couples to sit down and discuss, newlyweds, to discuss an area of tension in their marriage for 5 minutes. And they'll videotape this area, this conversation about a location of tension in the marriage for 5 minutes. And they can predict with 95% certainty who will get a divorce down the line. That's a really high number in my estimation, but you can look at the empirical research. What are they observing in that marital interaction that predicts? Mainly what they're coding is the prevalence of negative emotions. Okay? How much negative emotions are on display during this interaction between husband and wife. So my question is, obviously negative emotions are bad during that interaction, but some are better than others. Like, what do you think would be the worst negative emotion to see that would predict divorce? What would be the most toxic negative emotion? My guess would be anger, right? You know, if there's a lot of anger, that seems like that'd be predictive of divorce. But the thing about anger is a fairly egalitarian emotion. Like, two equals can feel angry at each other. And so there's nothing really dehumanizing about being mad at you. And so anger was actually not predictive of subsequent divorce. You know what was predictive of subsequent divorce? Contempt. If one of the spouses showed contempt for the other one, that was the most robust emotional predictor. Because now you have one spouse in a hierarchical relationship where the spouse is down, lower. And when that emerges, what the Bible calls two fleshes made one, when we start seeing contempt emerge, the emotion of otherness has emerged. And the spouse and their proximity and their body becomes a location of otherness. And intimacy becomes lost in that moment when the spouse is experienced as alien. My point here is that even if you don't have a lot of disgust for out-group members, you might have a lot of contempt. And I would argue particularly in 1 Corinthians 12, a famous location of failure of hospitality. In 1 Corinthians 12, the Corinthians are not waiting for each other at the communion table. Paul's encouraging them to wait on each other. As best we can tell in that situation, the richer members of the church were kind of treating with contempt the poorer members of the church. One of the places we know this is in the middle of Paul's famous body metaphor. We often think of that body metaphor as a discussion about giftedness, like some are prophets and some are, you know, teachers or whatever. But really, it's really a metaphor in contempt, because as you read towards the end of that body metaphor, he talks about those parts of the body that we treat with less honor and cover up are actually the parts of the body that God has shown greater honor. It's a reference to genitalia. He's saying there are some parts of the body that you consider shameful, so you put pants on and you can put clothing on, right? And you're putting those clothings on because you think those are shameful parts. But Paul flips it and he says, no, by clothing those parts, you're showing greater honor, special care and attention. And he says, these people that you find contemptible or disgusting or kind of unseemly, I want you to show them greater honor. So one of the things you can do in monitoring hospitality is paying attention to the way your church honors and shames. What is honored and given special attention and care? Is it the most contemptible members? Because that's what Paul is pointing to, the poor, contemptible members in the church. Let me end with this last domain, the domain of the body. When Jesus quotes the prophets, I desire mercy, not sacrifice, he actually quotes them twice in the book of Matthew. He quotes in Matthew 9, and then he quotes it again, I desire mercy, not sacrifice, in Matthew 12. In Matthew 12, you recall, the disciples are hungry on the Sabbath, and they're picking grain, and they're eating. And then they're judged for that eating and working on the Sabbath. Later on in that episode, Jesus goes into a synagogue and there's a man with a shriveled hand. And they want to see if Jesus will heal his shriveled hand. And so you see here Jesus talking about mercy, and now less in an area of hospitality, but in a context of hunger, in a context of malformity. Why is that interesting to me? Because the last area of disgust psychology is that we're not just disgusted by food and moral infractions in social groups, we're also disgusted by the body. Reliable disgust indicators are deformity, corpses, gore. And some of these things, psychologists have wrestled with these things. Those things don't really have to do with social groups, and it doesn't have to do with moral failures, and they don't really have to do anything with food. So what's going on there? Psychologists suggest that disgust in these instances is an existential protection. The body becomes a location of our feared mortality. We don't like being reminded of our need and our weakness and our eventual death. And so disgust, pushing those things away, becomes a way of avoiding from sight those things that might remind us during the day that we have physical bodies, and those physical bodies are subject to decay and illness and dementia and disability and eventual death. And so we push those things away. And not only do we push those things away about our own life, we push those kinds of populations to the side, the mentally ill, the mentally retarded, the Alzheimer's patients, those in wheelchairs. We like to push them out. We don't elevate those people to the center of society. We push them to the sides, and disgust helps us, prompts that kind of emotion. My point here is interesting that Jesus quotes again hospitality, mercy, in the face of hunger, in the face of disability. And one of the interesting things, I talked about this in Christian's class earlier, that he does here is he gives an example. He says to the Pharisees, which one of you, if you saw, you know, had a sheep and it fell into a ditch, would not go in and grab that sheep and pull it out on the Sabbath? I asked his class, what does the sheep represent? And we went through pets first, not a pet, children, not really a child, and then somebody finally chirped up and said, it's an economic illustration. I said, you're right, it's an economic illustration. Probably the best modern equivalent is, which one of you, if you dropped your wallet into the sewer, would not at least step down to pick it up. That sheep represents, you know, it's an economy here. What's interesting about that is that what Jesus does is he says, the reason why you're not being hospitable to hunger, like you can't appreciate that these men are hungry, the reason you are not empathic toward the man with the shriveled hand and disability is because you've become so insulated from your need. In your self-sufficiency, you have lost your ability to welcome or care for other people. And so Jesus has to point out their vulnerability. Your stock portfolio can plummet. You can have earlier onset dementia. You can get in a car accident and lose your cognitive capacities. You can give birth to a Down syndrome child. You are a mortal being. And if you ever lose track of that, your vulnerability, your heart will harden and become insensitive to the vast need all around us, physical and economic and all sorts of vulnerabilities. And so Jesus says, you are a physical being and you will care for yourself. And it's just because things are great now and you got plenty of sheep. Don't judge people who are hungry and show mercy to the man with the shriveled hand, even in the church building. And I think disgust regulates a great deal of that existential escapism. Thanatologists, these are people that study the culture of death, speak of America as typified by what is called the pornography of death. Death is pornographic in America because it is illicit. It's inappropriate to discuss. And I think the emotion of disgust is one of the things that helps push those mortality reminders to the side. And consequently, we live as if we have no bodies, and we're embarrassed to even have our bodies. My favorite example here, as I start wrapping up, I had a student that was in a coffee shop, and she had a horrible cold, and she was just had to blow her nose. And she was a kind of a neurotic person. She didn't want to be disgusting in public. And then she remembered this part of my lecture, and she goes, you know what? I have a body. I don't have to be ashamed that I have a body. I have snot, right? I am blowing my nose. And she blew her nose, you know. It's funny because we do like a large part of our cultural neurosis is pretending that we don't have a body, right? Or at least not letting anybody else know. Like, so hopefully I took care of my hygiene well enough that nobody noticed I actually had a body. That nobody smelled, you know, and hopefully if I used the restroom, I sprayed enough of that scent around that nobody would be alerted to the fact that on the earth, one body existed, right? Because we're all angels. Nobody sweats or smells or oozes. Nobody here, right? But one of the interesting things about hospitality is there are people out there with real bodies, and they often don't smell very good. I go to a church that ministers to homeless people, and you know, you learn to sing praise songs, and you got to master your olfactory senses when you sit next to some of my friends. And they could knock out a whole half of the auditorium, and you could walk in and go, oh my, they didn't shower today, and there's hardly anybody on this side but one person. And it takes an act of overcoming to sit by that body and show compassion and solidarity with those individuals. Let me kind of start wrapping this up a bit. What I'm arguing is that purity and the psychology it activates undermines hospitality in two different ways. I call this in the book a purity collapse. One thing I've shown you is that it causes us to run from people because through feelings of infrahumanization, through things of contempt and superiority. It causes us to withdraw from them because of negativity dominance and on and on. But it also causes us to become, it also affects our empathy. The purity collapse affects a flight from the body, our own body and the bodies of other people. And so it creates what Stanley Hauerwas, a theologian that you all might know, obviously, because of his work with Yoder, says that American spirituality is characterized as being too spiritual. And he means by too spiritual this kind of Gnostic escape from the body into this purity illusion that we are angelic beings without need or disability. So you might want to know how are we going to fix this? This is my favorite icon from the Greek Orthodox tradition. Does anybody know this icon? Some of you know this? It's called the Hospitality of Abraham. It's the events in Genesis 18 where three angelic visitors come to Abraham. And it's this story that sets up the whole hospitality trajectory for the Old and New Testaments. This welcoming strength. It's the one that's echoed in Hebrews, right? Do not forget to show hospitality to strangers because some have welcomed angels unawares, right? And it cascades all the way down through. And Jesus says in Matthew 9, anytime you welcome the sick or the naked or visit the prisoner, you're welcoming that stranger is me. The road to Emmaus story. Christ is encountered on the road as a stranger. And he's known when he's welcomed at the end of the day to stay. And it's in the breaking of bread that the Christ is known and recognized. And the welcoming of that stranger. It begins with this story. And so the hospitality of Abraham, it also became, for the Orthodox, a way of depicting the Trinity. You weren't allowed to paint an icon of God directly. So they would paint these three angelic visitors who visited Abraham, received his hospitality under the oaks of Mamre. The Spirit is on the left in green. The Son sits in the middle in brown. The Father sits on the right in that shimmering red. So it represents the Trinity. What I love about this is also there's a space at the front of the table for you and me, welcoming us into that loving community, receiving the hospitality of God. And the goblet's there, kind of has Eucharistic overtones. This idea of welcoming, being welcomed by God. Miroslav Volf calls this welcoming, the will to embrace. And he says this about it. The will to embrace is a judgment of other people that precedes any other judgment, any other sorting into moral categories, the saints and the sinners. Prior to any sorting of the sheep and goats, there has to be this fundamental commitment to embrace the humanity of the other person. And what that suggests to me is that fundamentally this act of hospitality is an affectional issue. It's a deep affectional issue that must be there. And if the affections are not in place, then we see all those toxic outcomes of exclusion and ostracization and stigmatization that we see in our culture. The will to embrace is this effective welcoming of other people, despite differences and disagreements and sharp, even moral divides, a fundamental sense that I recognize your humanity. I'm not engaging in this process of demonizing you and infrahumanizing you. You know, it's interesting. I often ask my students, have you ever heard the way to interface with the world as holy people is to love the sinners but hate the sin? Right? You've heard that, right? And then I say to them, how has the church done with that? And they're like, not very well. And I'd argue the reason why is it's a great little formula, but it's psychologically very difficult to pull that off because of what we've just talked about. It is difficult to see people engaged in these moral infractions and not allow that to affect our feelings about them. And so what happens is the purity collapse happens and we begin that process of demonizing those people and we see failures of hospitality. And so I asked my students, I said, how many of you actually think it's possible to love the sinners and hate the sin? Most of all of them think it's possible. And then I asked, I said, give me an example. Give me an example of how it's possible. And you know what examples they give me? They gave me examples of friends and family. My brother struggles with alcohol, and I hate that, you know, but he's my brother. Very rarely does somebody talk about some other people that they just love, although they disagree with them. It's always somebody that the will to embrace has already existed. They are my friend, they are my brother, and the sin is tragic because how much I love them and I will be with them. That's the difference between the way we typically do the culture wars where the will to embrace is nowhere in sight and we've already sorted saints and sinners to this feeling of the sin that I'm battling in my own life, the life of the people I care about. I think that's the texture it feels like. It feels like the way you hate the sin in somebody's life who you love very, very, very much. And if that's not secured, then I think it's actually pretty hard, if not impossible, to love the sinners but hate the sin. I would like, do I need to start wrapping up right about this point? I need to start wrapping up right around this point. All that to say is, I have more practical things to say, but I'll hold off. Maybe they'll come up in the Q&A. All that to say is, what we're calling the church to do is no easy thing. And equipping the students of this university or your churches or even your own family and children with simple maxims like love the sinner and hate the sin isn't getting at the deep affectional capacities that need to be cultivated. It is not easy to embrace other people. It is not easy to hold their dignity and their humanity in high esteem when we are sharply disagreeing. But that is fundamentally where hospitality begins. It doesn't begin in being nice. It doesn't begin in kind of rearranging the environment. It fundamentally begins with embracing the humanity of the person directly in front of you and loving them the way Christ loved us. Two, in his words, to desire mercy over sacrifice. Thank you for your attendance and your time. I'll turn it over to you. Questions we can take for you? Yes.
I'm Richard. I'm Lester. I teach in the physical education department.
Uh-huh.
So we like to think we revere the body.
Yeah.
You didn't say this explicitly, but you kind of argued that our natural state, our psychology, depicts a fallenness. That this expulsive response and all of that's our natural state. Is there something in creation as well that can depict, be a metaphor for our redemption? I mean, I like to think that that the creation also gives us the positive picture.
Mm-hmm.
But to listen to you, the picture you've kind of presented is that everything natural about us is given to hostility and separation.
Yeah.
Are there natural men? You know what I'm getting at?
Right. So the question is, I've tended to paint a picture of kind of our natural bias to be expulsive and those kinds of things. Is there a positive aspect to creation? And I would say that if I overplayed the naturalness, what I was trying to do is say that there is a natural psychology related to food and oral incorporation that then perhaps gets unnaturally imported or easily imported into these other domains. And I'd also say, for those of you that are in the humanities and cultural analyses, that psychologists tend to be reductionistic, and you probably want to talk about culture and how different cultures deal with disgust and contamination and things like that. So some of the things about the body that I was talking about, I would not say necessarily natural. I would say that they have tended to be examples of kind of the way Western Americans have dealt with the body. And so I wouldn't necessarily say that was a comment about creation, and because I do think there's other cultures, and particularly in the Hebrew, I think the Hebrew Bible has a higher view of the body in incarnational theology and sacramental kinds of theology. So I do think, I wouldn't want to say it's natural. I would say that what has happened in America is disgust psychology has been important to the body because of our death avoidance, and that that doesn't necessarily have to be so. That we could then push against that by doing what you all would do, which is having a robust incarnational theology about the goodness of creation, and therefore not have all this neurotic ambivalence about the body.
Now, that'd be my challenge, is search for a positive metaphor of hospitality in the body, in the creation.
Yeah, and I think Paul tries to do that in Corinthians 12, that all we are all parts of the same body, and therefore we can't shame or honor other parts. So I do think he's trying to come up with a body metaphor that kind of is hospitable, because he's using the body metaphor to talk about how the richer members of the church should be hospitable to, wait for at the table, the less honorable. But they're having this honor-shame issue with the body as well. But he's trying to invert that. He's trying to say these shameful parts of the body are actually being treated with special attention and care because they're, beloved by God. don't know if that gets it, kind of what you're saying. But I do think there's a body metaphor there that could be used. Other questions?
Do you think the Christian mission would be well served if it were more rational?
More rational? I really think it would be better if it was more emotional. But the trouble is that the emotions are hard to corral and tame. I think in many ways, Christianity is extraordinarily maybe too rational. At least in my church, like we go to Sunday school, and so it's a very rationalistic kind of discussion about theology, but it's not getting down to the affections. And so we can talk about hospitality and analyze hospitality, and it's very rational, but we haven't created the affective or emotional capacities to be hospitable people. That's not to say that you should downplay doctrine. What I'm talking about is spiritual formation efforts being too cognitive and cerebral, perhaps. Does that make sense?
It sounded to me like drinking lemonade out of a bedpan.
It's
not a problem for a rational person.
Yeah.
But Christianity, my education teaches me that Christianity is essentially irrational. You might have a Sunday school, but you teach virgin birth. Maybe your church doesn't, but this church does.
No, our church does. Mm-hmm.
Virgin birth and bodily resurrection, and things which are irrational. Mm-hmm. So the conundrum seems to me, how do you get the Christian to act rationally if their worldview is irrational?
Well, I would argue that in many ways that what we're asking people to do is very, I don't know if I would use it irrational, but definitely counterintuitive. Like Jesus is eating with the tax collectors and sinners is very counterintuitive. Like I was talking about negativity dominance. It doesn't make sense that you would be purified by embracing the unclean, but yet that's what Jesus does. That's what he calls us to do. That doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. Our general tendency when we're dealing with purity issues is to quarantine ourselves.
Well, I thought that was Jesus' point. Jesus' point would be what you're doing is irrational.
To the Pharisees?
Yeah. Do the rational thing.
Yeah, I mean, we would just quibble on whether or not, you know, I don't know if Jesus would be framing the debate between them as rational or irrational. I think he's talking about there's a certain logic that you're ruling your life by, and within that logic, it's rational what you're doing. Given these assumptions, what you're doing is rational. Jesus is questioning those fundamental assumptions, and so therefore, I would say, yeah, he'd be critiquing the rationality of that whole structure. But I would say within their worldview, the Pharisees were being very logical. I mean, what they're doing, very straightforward. But Jesus is questioning that whole system. So I'd say he's probably rejecting the premises or the axioms of the rationality in play, replacing it with a more rational one. Yeah, no. Questions?
A comment on you earlier. The first question, perhaps as a bodily metaphor for radical acceptance across profound differences, that reproductive sex might be one. But that, and in response to the question here, my question is, what purpose could have been served by this over, you're saying that there's an over-application of our correctly evolved bodily disgust reactions that are appropriate and have survival value to the social domain, but might that always be inappropriate? Might there be situations or conditions under which, indeed, the reason that there's been survival value in these purity, separation of my community from the world kind of logics, and in particular, in response to profound trauma, in war, that sort of thing. Do you have any, can you relate trauma to a potential historical survival value of these purity things?
Right. So the question was, again, I'm just repeating for the film, is there any, in the presentation I've tended to portray the application of disgust and boundary monitoring and as across the board a bad thing? Might there be helpful, adaptive, appropriate uses of expulsive mechanisms or boundary monitoring mechanisms for different communities, moral communities? Is that the question?
Yeah.
Okay. The answer is yes. I think so. And I think that's the tension, because again, the mechanism at root is inherently a protective mechanism. And I think somebody would probably like to bring up, and I tease Tara about this, it's interesting to bring a book like this into a Mennonite community where the issues of the moral integrity of the community is a prime value, and certain practices about monitoring the moral integrity of the group might run in conflict to what I'm trying to say. And like, did not Paul say, right, also don't even eat with such a one who was displaying a moral failure? And so he talks about a withdrawal from that person for the sake of maintaining the moral witness and the integrity of that brother. I would say in the book I try to wrestle with that text, and the simple answer is I would say that those boundary establishing kinds of things do take place in a wide variety of moral contexts. I would argue though that the will to embrace has to be in place before those activities take place. And Paul's even clear about that, right? The brother is turned over for their eventual rehabilitation here. It's a form of care for that brother, not necessarily for the community as well. So I would say that those forms of exclusion or expulsion would be toxic if the will to embrace, the humanity of the one being expelled, is compromised, and they were infrahuman, you know, they were treated as, you know. And I might be crazy. No, let's be clear, I probably am. But what's interesting, Jesus even talks about if you're not reconciled with the brother, you know, treat them as a tax collector and a pagan, which is ironic for Jesus to say, or just intriguing, given the way he treated tax collectors and sinners, you know? I mean, so he just treat this one. So I would even argue sometimes that the minute that the person is identified as a tax collector and sinner, hospitality in a certain kind of way ramps back up in the way he ate with tax collectors and sinners. I think you could kind of maybe make an interesting argument there. That might be a bit strained for some. But all that to say is yes, I do think there's places where the moral integrity of the church has to be dealt with, and a purity psychology would be appropriate at that point. We have lots of questions. I think your hand was up. Can we go this way? Yes.
You mentioned the cross. Can you tie in your ideas about purity and uncleanness with theories of the atonement?
The question was, can I tie in the issues of the cross and theories of atonement with this? Oh, my goodness. There's lots of theories of the atonement. The one thing I would say when I think about the cross is kind of what I said about Hebrews. And I mean, to me, when I fundamentally look at the cross, I see it as the kind of the ultimate, I mentioned this in chapel, the incarnation and the cross kind of represent the kind of the ultimate acts of welcome, right? That God, in the incarnation, embraces humanity, takes on humanity. And I think the sequence of the cross is interesting, right? Christ dies for us while we were yet sinners. And so there is a hospitality offered, a welcoming, a will to embrace that is manifested in the cross. But the idea of, and the way he stands in solidarity with the God forsaken and the God cursed, the one who hung on a tree is cursed by God. So Jesus kind of stands in solidarity with the God, with the cursed. One of my favorite quotes from the theologian William Stringfellow is, the first place to look for Jesus is in hell, because he stands in solidarity with the God forsaken. And I think that's a radical show of hospitality. How it deals with the cleansing aspects, that's an interesting issue. I don't know if I can, it'd be too long probably to perhaps get into, but it is interesting how the Day of Atonement cleansing rituals are. So I think a lot of it would have to do with, what do you mean, you know, so Jesus cleanses us. My worries about, let me just express a worry. Here's a rambling answer. My worry is that once certain atonement metaphors say that through the blood of Jesus I'm washed clean, my worry is, and I think that's true, I believe that. My worry is then what that does is that because of that status, it makes us paranoid about preserving the state of ritual purity, and therefore hesitant to extend hospitality for fear of mucking up, you know, this pure, soiling this kind of state. And so to me, I think the purity metaphors there are great and true, but I do think they have certain vulnerabilities and temptations, and one of them is to just play it safe. You know, I'm saved, and now my job is to play it safe. So why risk? No, why risk the boundary crossing and jeopardize, at least that's the way I was taught, you know, you're jeopardizing your salvation by, so it's just easier to just kind of go, I'll pray for those people, you know, but I don't know if I'll extend hospitality. So I do think there's something worrisome about it. I don't know how to overcome it, really. Just to say, but Jesus calls us to a purity that is embodied in hospitality. Over here.
Just to pick up on this classic text, Matthew 18, that you were referring
right.
to, what do you do when there's tension or violation uh-huh. or conflict in your community? First you go directly to
uh-huh,
the
right.
sister, you bring in a third-party mediator. Sometimes you have to bring the whole community to bear, like Martin Luther King did, you know, challenging Southern Jim Crow laws, bring the whole community to bear. But then, if they still won't repent or they still won't stop their violation, treat them like a tax collector or a sinner. You rightly point out, how did Jesus do that radical hospitality to those people? But right before that text, he tells the story of the 99 and the one sheep, and that even though you got 99 in the pen, you go out for the one sheep.
Yeah.
This incredible, you know, it seems like most of us would be happy if we had 99 in the fold
yeah.
and just one out there.
Yeah.
That's not good enough for Jesus. He's going to go out and risk it all, you know, leave the others unattended to get that one that's been lost, to bring them back into the fold. And then right after that saying, he says, how many times should I forgive? Peter asks him, 70 times 7, you know, this incredible forgiveness and restoration. So it seems like Jesus gives us a lot of ways to frame, yes, there is this some kind of moral pressure and persuasion and even boundaries, but on one side, the 99 and the one sheep, on the other side,
yep.
forgive 70 times 7, and in the middle, treat him like a tax collector. Well, how did Jesus treat tax
yep.
collector with radical hospitality?
Yeah.
So it shouldn't be these negative ways of doing it. I think Jesus, if you understand,
yeah.
it's pretty clear.
Perhaps, ascend, like I said, like ascending towards that person in a certain sense. And by the way, I think Dr. King is an excellent example of somebody with stark moral disagreements and very aggressive in his demand for justice, who manifested in his rhetoric the will to embrace. Always tried to preserve the humanity of the people he was upset with. I think he was a master at that kind of forceful prophetic voice without demonizing the white population. I think he was excellent at trying to maintain that balance. You know, we love, you know the Southern sheriff throwing us in jail. We still love him. We're going to get in his face, but we still love him. You know what I'm saying? I think he was really great at that. There was a hand up here in this area. Yes, sir.
Yes. What does radical hospitality have to do with economics?
What does it have to do with economics?
Yes. Uh-huh. Do you think people's desire to own objects, is that connected to owning
others? Oh, I mean, yeah, I think there's lots of different ways we can be hospitable or inhospitable. I mean, some of it is what I've been talking about is interpersonal, but I do think economic systems can be hospitable or inhospitable or welcoming or unwelcoming in that sense. Therefore, the way we participate in those systems as well. And so I would argue that the idea of hospitality, making room, you know, if you kind of use that. Is anybody familiar with Christine Pohl's book, Making Room? Excellent book on Christian hospitality, I recommend. But I think making room is not just, I've been arguing it's affectional, but it's also social and political and I think economic. How do we make room for everybody, you know, economically. And we talked at Christian's class this morning a little bit about, you know, the Jubilee and those kinds of things. Does that? I would definitely much, you know, I mean, there's a longer answer that could be said, but I definitely think hospitality has economic consequences. And then, you know, and we can expand that out further. Hospitality to the world, the earth, the animals. I mean, you can talk about making room for lots of different kinds of interesting debates at all those different locations. Hospitable to creation. Thank you all so much for coming.